Are same-sex schools beneficial for students?
Now, Ethan, that's a hard question, because I think a lot of it depends on what you're really going for at a school. I mean, there are plenty of schools that try to focus on the academics, and I know a few folks who've gone to either Iron Academy or St. Mary's here in Raleigh.
Okay.
And they claim that without the opposite sex around, they can actually focus on the school part of school.
Really?
That's at least the idea. What do you think? Is that would that make school better for you?
Well, while it's nice to not be distracted in school, at first, I don't really see that side of the whole distraction argument, but my argument would be that there's so many social benefits to having the opposite sex around and actually being able to interact in a in an educational environment with the opposite sex to be able to bounce ideas off of each other. I think the social benefits of education are really underrated and definitely weigh a lot more than most people would think.
Well, certainly as a teacher, I think from my point of view, I see those social interactions, and some of them are positive, some of them are less so. But that's not really what we're here to talk about today. Ethan, what's our resolution today on What's the Res?
Today's resolution for What's the Res comes from the Calvin Coolidge Foundation, and it is, the United States federal government should make reducing the national debt a fiscal priority.
Well, before we get too deep into this, let's welcome our listeners. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to What's the Res, an ongoing conversation about the current resolutions in the world of high school debate. My name is Josh Herring. I'm a debate coach and humanities instructor at Thales Academy, Rollsville, and I'm joined by one of my best debaters, Ethan Delves. And today we're going to be talking about and analyzing this resolution for the upcoming Luddy Debate League tournament at Thales Academy, Rollsville. And just as a quick word to anyone who's listening and is not yet registered, that tournament is open to all students, grades 6 through 12, those who are inside the Luddy schools of Thales Academy, Franklin Academy, or St. Thomas More Academy. But for the first time ever, this tournament is now open to folks who are outside of the Luddy schools. So if you're listening to this and you're in the Raleigh area and you want to come to a debate tournament on February 16th, check out our show notes where you'll see the link that'll take you straight to the webpage to register through the Coolidge Foundation. So with that, once again, we are here today to talk about the statement resolved. The United States federal government should make reducing the national debt a fiscal priority. Well, Ethan, as a student who's preparing for that debate tournament, walk us through some of your initial thoughts. What do you see happening in that resolution?
My first thought automatically goes to the grammar of the resolution. The number one thing that catches my eye is a fiscal priority and what that means for something to be a fiscal priority, because that I think is a really ambiguous term. So really the grammar of the resolution stands out to me, and how the affirmative and negative would act in an approach to come towards a clash in thoughts as to what a fiscal priority entails.
Sure, that certainly seems like a really important piece of this resolution. So we've got the fiscal priority. Now, even before that, of course, we've got our subject, the United States federal government, and we've got an action that the agent should take.
Right.
So reducing the national debt, and then making that a fiscal priority is going to be the trick for this resolution, I think.
And how to go about reducing the national debt. Knowing that the national debt is currently at around $21.96 trillion, how do you go about reducing an amount? That's quite the large amount, I would argue.
You're right. And of course, I'm sure many of our listeners are already familiar with this, but if not, they should definitely check it out. The debt clock is a really helpful tool to keep track of just how much the debt is growing. We'll be sure to put a link to that in the show notes.
Right.
But the national debt is a huge problem, and that's part of what this resolution is all about. How do we fix a problem that's that big?
Right, and how soon should we fix it, being the center point of the resolution?
Yeah, those are, and really, now maybe we should back this up just a moment, because I know certainly when I first looked at this resolution, I was less clear than I am now on what exactly the national debt is.
Right.
Ethan, walk us through the exactly what the national debt is, and how did it get to this point of almost $22 trillion?
Right. So every year, the United States government sets a budget, a federal budget, that is going to use to operate. And last year, this federal budget was $4.11 trillion. And every time the U.S. sets this budget, it taxes the citizens for their money in order to pay to run society for that year. And last year, the government taxed the citizens for $3.33 trillion. Mm. And you can see that that does not amount to $4.11 trillion. Therefore, the remainder of the money must be borrowed in order to make up the difference in the amount. And this money is borrowed from a lot of different areas. We borrow from foreign countries. We, in fact, borrow from ourselves. And the government inter-borrows within itself. And this is called the federal deficit, the difference between how much money we spend and how much money we have collected in taxes. And that deficit gets stacked up over the years for every yearly deficit. And that is what accumulates into what we call the national debt.
So when we're talking about the national debt, part of this seems like relatively simple math. I mean, those were big numbers, but we're literally talking about subtracting one sum from another and looking at the difference.
Right, and then adding that up over the years as it gets larger and larger.
So it's taken us several years to get to this point.
Correct. It really has. Yeah, it's taken a while. But it has increased exponentially, like, more recently. It's been going up a lot faster than it has over the over earlier years.
Oh, and Ethan, are you familiar with kind of the way debt works?
Yes.
So walk us through kind of the way borrowing and interest rates can kind of compound, and how borrowing in over multiple years, how does that create a bigger problem than people might initially think?
Right. So in order to borrow money, what you need is lenders, because lenders are what will give the money to the United States government. As I stated earlier before, the United States government goes to many different places to find these lenders. One, it will go to foreign countries. I believe they hold about 1/3 of our federal debt so far. And when we go to these foreign countries, the way that they give us money is we sell them treasury bonds, so bonds that are attached to our treasury. And these are rather safe investments, and that's one of the key factors in this resolution, is how safe are these investments and how does that play into us needing to pay back this debt, and how soon does that mean we have to pay back this debt. But other countries, as well as parts of the government within itself, will buy treasury bonds because that's the way that the debt is accumulated. And these bonds have interest on them. The United States government is expected to pay back these bonds in increments of, I believe, 1, 5, or 10 years, depending on what kind of bond it is. Now, when this bond is due, the government oftentimes finds that it cannot pay back the money that it has to. So what the government does is it borrows more money to pay off the money that it originally borrowed. And this causes interest rates to actually go up, because countries and all of the bonds that were sold, well, these places will start to lose faith that the United States government is actually going to be able to pay back the money without having to borrow more and more to pay it back. And this is one of the central problems in this debate, is the United States going to keep on borrowing to pay off everything that it's owed so far? So really, these interest rates that are going up and all of the foreign countries owning our treasury bonds is one of the things that I feel like we should focus on for this episode.
Really, from what you're describing, it sounds like this national debt problem is not really that different from an individual citizen's debt problem.
Well, you can definitely look at it in that way, with that analogy, but I think there are some key differences to pay attention to as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
And certainly one of those is, I think, is certainly the fact that the government can continue borrowing even if it's more
right.
expensive.
The government does always have a way to borrow some more money, and that's why people feel so safe investing in the government treasury bonds, because they feel 100% secure in the fact that to get their money back, or the ROI that they expected, the government will either borrow more money to pay that original amount back, or it has the power to tax the citizens. Therefore, it's a very safe investment to make.
So even at the point where the United States federal debt is now outpacing the annual gross domestic product of
right.
the country, there's still a pretty strong confidence in the United States as a government, and that it is, in fact, fiscally solvent.
Well, so far, people still seem to have confidence. I believe the United States has A++ rating, I think is what it was called, for confidence that this debt will actually be paid back. So countries and agencies within the government are quite certain they're going to get their money back, because the United States government has a mechanism by which to do this.
Well, that's probably pretty good in terms of thinking through the grammar of this resolution.
Right.
But let's focus on that phrase, fiscal priority. Now that certainly seems to establish really ranking this pretty high on the levels of
right.
what the government should focus on. And I was thinking through there are plenty of other things that Congress allocates money to.
Right.
Some of those include entitlement spending, anything in our welfare programs like Social Security or FICA and so on. Our military spending is a huge section of that.
Right.
Of course, so is education. There are lots of things. Ethan, do you have any suggestions as to what exactly making this a priority, what would that look like? What would it mean to actually make this a fiscal priority?
So one thing to note right now is that the debt is not something that's inexpensive. In fact, every year, 1.4% of our GDP is spent on paying back interest on the debt. So not even the principal amount, but the interest that comes in every year. It's called financing the debt, is holding off those interest payments until the principal payment comes due. So making this a fiscal priority would look like cutting spending for a lot of the agencies and institutions that are a part of the government. One way to do this would be to cut funds going to them in order to take that money and pay off part of the principal amount of the national debt and make a dent in that. So that could cause a lot of institutions losing money on behalf of the government.
Now, I suspect that the people who are either employed in those agencies or the beneficiaries of the services those agencies provide would not really want to see those budgets slashed.
Right. It's definitely not an easy thing to do. Paying off the national debt is not like at the snap of a finger. It would take some time, and somebody is going to experience some drawbacks. And I think one of the key parts of this debate is looking at, are the short-term drawbacks of paying off the U.S. debt going to be beneficial for future generations or further down the line? What are the costs and benefits of the short-term as well as the long-term?
Yeah, that short-term, long-term difference is critical, and it's certainly something that is it's hard to really focus on in the moment, because certainly in the moment, there are each year in our political cycle, there are different causes that somehow seem to be at the forefront of the national discussion. I'm thinking currently President Trump has made quite a big deal about his wall.
Right.
And as we'll talk about on our next episode, the Democratic Party is currently focusing on a lot of environmental legislation that has a hugely imminent part to it that they're focusing on. We have to change things now.
Right.
Whereas what you're describing really is, these are questions of a long-term view. Now, what happens if a government reaches that point of maybe paying down their debt to a greater extent, or maybe even on the opposite side, what happens if our debt continues to grow and we don't pay it down?
So I think a really good way to frame this debate is by looking at debt in terms of debt to GDP ratio, because a country you need to be able to look at how much money a country makes in right next to the amount of debt that the country has, because without that proportional relationship, it's really hard to see just how significant the debt looks. Just recently, the United States federal debt has surpassed the amount of GDP that we have, and we're on track for that ratio to keep on getting into a wider and wider gap. So in order to go about paying this off, like what this would look like for long-term and short-term, I feel like the affirmative side of the debate is really focusing on why this is necessary now. And a key point to look at there is why exactly is this necessary to do right now? Like, what implications does this mean for, 10, 20 years down the line if we don't start paying off the debt? What economic repercussions will we have? Or even worse, how much harder will it be to pay off later than if we don't get a head start on this? However, the negative side of the debate, I think, is looking at more of why is this not a fiscal priority? What could we be doing now that will help the debt sort of waver off or go away slowly? And it's really not this urgent thing that we must focus all of our funds into.
Mm-hmm.
But if we put our money elsewhere, then the debt will sort of solve itself, if that makes sense.
Sure. We'll get into that probably a little bit more in just a moment.
Right.
But one of the fascinating things that we really could, I think it's also worth considering here, is that if you have a government that is debt-free, or at least much closer to debt-free, which seems almost impossible with the size of the numbers and the scope of the issue that we're discussing. But if we were at that point, it fascinates me to think about what could a government do if it was taking all those funds that are currently going to debt, and what if it was putting those funds into internal infrastructure or towards providing other services for its citizens. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont has made quite a big stir about with his claims that government should provide free college education to all citizens. That's an enormously costly proposal if it was to ever go through. But if we had a government that was not putting this much of its tax receipts into repaying debts, maybe ideas like that would be much more feasible. But in contrast, it seems like if we are locked into paying down debt, it really does remove a lot of the flexibility and freedom that a government could have.
And just to kind of name part of this flexibility, so for a numerical amount of how much the federal government currently spends every year financing the debt, that would be $371 billion.
Oh,
so to look at the maneuverability, not only would we save this much, this amount of money per year, but as the debt gets progressively lower, so this number would get progressively lower, And imagine what you could do with $371 billion. You could run more than half the military with that amount of money. Like, just to give some context, that is no small sum of cash.
True. I grew up in a military town, one in Tennessee, in Clarksville, Tennessee, near Fort Campbell, and also in Chesapeake, Virginia, with Oceana Air Base and Portsmouth Naval Base as almost next-door neighbors. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard people describing outdated equipment,
right.
Particularly our naval aircraft carriers. Our generations, at least as what I remember being told as a kid, are several generations out of date. And a part of updating that is you're talking about multi-million dollar equipment upgrades that it always seems easier to either patch than to necessarily create a whole new aircraft carrier. But that kind of equipment upgrade could become much more possible.
Right.
Well, let's kind of, unless there's, are there any other things you wanted to kind of mention specifically on the res, or should we then kind of shift to thinking particularly about case writing suggestions for
I think we've covered pretty much all. I think we've gone over some implications as far as where spending would be cut and cut the debt over a short period of time versus a long period of time. I think we're good to move on to some case writing tips.
All right, that sounds great. Well, how about, I'm going to suggest what I would encourage students to think about for the affirmative, and then I'll feed it your way, and then let's do the same thing on NEG.
Okay.
So for those who are listening, who are thinking about this upcoming tournament as you're writing your cases, the big question that I've encouraged my students to think about for the affirmative is, what is your specific plan? What specifically do you mean by reducing or by making the reducing the national debt a fiscal priority? Ethan suggested several pieces in a recent article for the American Spectator. Mr. Bob Luddy suggested actually cutting federal spending by 22% in order to really halt the growth of the debt. And in that article, which is entitled Debt and Deficits, They're Unsustainable, published on January 15th of 2019, he explains that this would be really painful for a lot of areas of the government, but really that's what's necessary to do that. Now, I'm not necessarily encouraging everyone to use Mr. Luddy's argument as theirs, but that's an example of the kind of specificity that would make for an effective case strategy, where on your affirmative case, you're going to argue for a specific plan to say, here's what this means to make this a fiscal priority. And then maybe secondly, I think really the affirmative case should focus on the long-term advantages of a fiscally solvent government and really what that could do for making a better country. Ethan, what would you suggest as some affirmative strategies?
So I would definitely agree with your point on the plan. If the affirmative doesn't have a plan, the negative team can easily come up in cross-examination and ask, how would you go about doing this? And that's a completely valid question in the debate. If I were affirmative,
that's
I would
right.
want to be ready to respond to the negative team, here's how we're going to do this. And in this way, I feel like you have to look at the plan and try to navigate certain areas, because cutting 22% of government spending is definitely no small amount, and that would suffocate a lot of different areas in some ways, but it may be necessary. So the affirmative team, I feel like, has to find a good ground to work with as far as making sure that not too much spending is cut, but are there other ways to make this a fiscal priority than just cutting spending in one area or another. But in addition to this, I would also look at the long-term implications. I'm thinking mainly future generations.
Mm.
And what is doing this now? Like, why is now more important than, say, 5-10 years from now? Like, this debate and this resolution has come up now for a reason. And we need to look at why is it important in 2019? And I think one good kind of indicator of this is how the debt recently rose above the GDP level. This could very well be the spark as to why people are thinking about this now. Because we owe more money than we're bringing in, does that have a heavy weight on why we should act at this very moment? And does acting at this very moment have any longevity to it at all? Does this plan mean cutting spending right away and in 3 years we would have paid off this amount of the debt? Or is it implementing a plan now that can work over time to help effectively combat this debt? And what could we do with the extra money that we would have? And what kind of maneuverability as a government we would have? Does having more money and less debt restrain us in any international ways? Because as we'll get into later, it surely does. And are these things worth cutting our funds in the short term to certain areas of the government, and how will these implications such as national security or more money being borrowed from the taxpayers in the short term go towards things like, just like I said, national security, but as well going into things like the future economics, and what will it look like for our future generations to have that weight taken off of them?
Sure. I'm glad you mentioned mentioned that last part about future generations, because I think part of one thing we haven't mentioned yet is that several economists have speculated that the only way that we actually could pay down this debt, if we do not cut government spending, is we're looking at a massive tax increase.
Right.
And so that, of course, provides an additional burden that's felt by the American taxpayer in a profound way. Well, let's shift and think about the neg, because I think it's in one sense, I think affirmative has an easier case to make.
Right.
It's easier to convince people that it does help to pay down the debt.
Yeah.
But of course, this is a debate, so we've got to have equal ground on neg. So Ethan, why don't you start us off with some negative strategies, and then I'll take it from there.
Right. So there's two sides of the debate. There's looking at short-term impacts and long-term impacts, and the affirmative team is really looking at the long-term. However, the negative team is looking at the short-term impacts mainly for why we shouldn't make this debt a fiscal priority now. The neg has a couple questions and implications to answer to in order to make their case, because the first burden of the neg is to answer to the affirmative and refute the affirmative case. Negative team, look at the plan that the affirmative is putting towards you. If the affirmative team comes with a plan, be ready to ask, why would this plan be effective? In what area, like, pick apart the different areas of the plan and really look inside of the affirmative case to see if this is one, practical, and two, will it be sustainable for the economy to manage, considering how much money we've cut from different areas of the government. Additionally, the negative team should look at why this is not really an urgent issue. Like, really stress that the affirmative team is instituting a certain level of fear into the resolution. This is urgent and bad things will happen if we don't address it. The negative team has to be able to calm people down and say, wait, this isn't urgent. If we make this a fiscal priority, one, it could have these drawbacks, but additionally, two, if we do this instead, the debt could possibly work itself out in these ways, or doing this instead would make the debt a manageable thing that we could have that doesn't necessarily draw us back as an economy holistically.
Those are some great thoughts. I was talking to a friend to take this out of governmental theory for just a second and put this in terms of real people. I was talking to a friend who has a major car repair coming up, and he started analyzing what exactly is it worth fixing his car, and it was going to cost him another $1,000 to keep his car on the road. And he decided actually that he might be ready to get rid of that car and buy something new. But his question was, okay, so what down payment can I bring, and how can I buy a car with the lowest possible car payment? Now, I'm of the conviction that I don't ever want to have a car payment. My friend has a different perspective on that. He's instead looking for, where can I have is this the most manageable car payment?
Right.
That way, how can I have a nice car that does what I need it to do, but that I'm actually paying less than $100 per month?
And does having this incremental car payment, is that necessarily a bad thing? Because a lot of people would argue on the negative side, having a debt is not a bad thing. A debt can actually empower an economy by borrowing this money. Now we have money to inject into the economy. Debt can possibly spark economic growth under the negative case. And I think that's an important point for them to focus on. Mm-hmm. Negative team, look at what you can do for the economy with the debt in place that, one, keeps the debt in check, and two, uses the debt to help boost the economy in a way that has longevity in mind. That's a really good way to go directly against the affirmative, saying, we're taking away the sense of urgency and we can do this instead, and the economy will actually be better off than expected.
Just to put a couple other names to what Ethan was just describing, that idea of using debt as kind of a propellant to sort of accelerate the natural course of the economy, that's one of the ideas developed by British economist John Maynard Keynes. So if you were to do a Google search for Keynesian economics, that's spelled K-E-Y-N-E-S-I-A-N, Keynesian economics. Keynesian economics argues that governments ought to provide that acceleration through lending money to people and corporations so that the government becomes the source of capital. And then for Keynes, government spending was actually a really good thing, and government debt was a method of propelling the economy. And there's kind of a new version of, I think they're connected ideas, and I don't know as much about this one, but it's certainly one an economist recommended to me. He suggested I look into modern monetization theory as part of this, and certainly that's a key element that the negative could focus on. Because modern monetization theory is looking at the idea that governments could print more money in order to spur further economic activity. And the argument is that if they do this responsibly, they can print enough money to pay their own debts and to spur economic activity without triggering an inflation crisis. And one example of a government that's followed this approach effectively is the country of Japan. They have an economic group that controls just how much money is created to be put into circulation, and they can create more cash, more currency. In their case, it's the yen. But they do that as in response to more economic activity. So the government spending more money in a responsible way becomes a mechanism for spurring economic growth. And Ethan, just to kind of wrap this up, is there an argument for the NEG about economic growth as a way to actually pay down the debt and maybe to accomplish both of these goals?
Right. So using what you just said about using the debt as a tool to help propel economic growth, that's one aspect that the NEG has to focus on if they're willing to make this argument. Just a quick recommendation for any debaters on each side of the debate. The affirmative and the negative are two completely different worlds is a really good way to think of it. And there are different values and theories and philosophies in each world. To all the debaters out there, don't be afraid to delve into these different worlds. And really, you can just, what I would recommend is going and doing research on each of these things. Go to the affirmative first and the negative. See what people out there are saying and see what people really just take apart what each of these articles are saying. A lot of them actually do have arguments that we have been talking about recently, like the propelling the economy with the debt. When you put money towards a debt, or rather borrow money, and you put this into the economy, this can help with economic growth, but I think that what the negative should focus on is, again, debt to GDP ratio. What the negative is saying is that as long as the ratio is safe and sustainable, the debt isn't really that much of an important, or rather, using terms from the resolution, a fiscal priority. If you look at it from a ratio standpoint, if it's safe and it's manageable and we carry it into the future, our economy is strong and our economy will continue to be strong, so why should we worry about the debt? Well, the affirmative is saying eventually this debt is going to catch up to us and we need to act on it now.
Well, that's probably a great reason, a great way to transition to our to kind of wrapping this up with thinking about three big questions of the debate. So really what you were just getting at, Ethan, is really a way of thinking about question number one that really this debate is all about, which I would word as, is money reflecting real economic choices? And the affirmative side is really taking the approach that, yes, what we do with our money reflects real economic choices. And because the federal government has taken on this debt, eventually someone will have to pay that debt. And we would be better off to pay it now than to pay it later.
Right.
Whereas the negative is really taking a different position and saying, no, money is actually a tool that we can use, and we can use it in various ways, and we can use that tool in ways that you utilize debt or in ways that don't utilize debt, but money is something we can really shift around in different ways, and it's not quite as real as maybe the affirmative is asserting that
right.
It is.
Yeah, I would completely agree with you. The affirmative kind of has this obligation put on the U.S. government that what's due will be paid. But the negative can make a strong case for how this can actually be a tool, as you were saying, where if you have this debt lingering out there but you can finance it, does it really have to be paid off? Does this principal amount really matter that much? Because if you look at it on paper, this debt being out there but not paid off, as long as you finance it, it truly does not have to be paid off, because China can't simply snap its fingers one day and say, my amount has come due. That's really not how it works. So does this actually, Mr. Herring, have to be paid off or made a fiscal priority? Like, how can the debt possibly be out there, yet how can it just be financed in that way and not actually paid down?
Well, I mean, in terms of actual personal view, I would side much more heavily with affirmative on this
right.
one. Because I think originally, actually, money does really matter, and it does reflect actual value. And in this case, I think we're really getting into one of the more traditional ideas of debt that shows up in the Old Testament book of Proverbs in the Bible, which talks about the borrower is slave to the lender. Hmm. And this is just a fundamental reality, whether we're talking about gold and silver, whether we're talking about paper currency, whether we're talking about digital currency or cryptocurrency. The borrower is slave to the lender. And in that case, the United States government has functionally enslaved itself to someone or a group of people. And in so doing, it actually compromises the security of the United States people, because its government is enslaved through debt.
Right.
So it's ultimately going to be a good if we actually free the United States from its debt bondage that it's undertaken.
I would say that would give the United States much more maneuverability as a nation. And really what is borrowed can come due and has to come due eventually. You can't simply pay interest. I would side with you and agree with you on the debt for longevity and just keep on doing that. But there's still that 21 and increasing principal amount laying there, that something has to be done with that.
Well, we've really kind of, in that case, already addressed the second big question I wanted to get at, whether does a government have a moral obligation to pay its debts? And the affirmative is really functionally suggesting the answer is yes.
Right.
While negative is proposing, no, not really. What if a government could use debt to bring about a better economy for the presently existing citizens? And maybe that's really what a government has to do.
Right. Would you think that an economy can be good under debt? Are there some benefits that you can see where having an economy that's going extremely strong, yet there's debt behind it, is that a truly strong economy?
Well, see, I think that really this is a place where I want to kind of reverse a thought experiment that Plato came up with a long, long, long time ago, where he argued if we were really going to understand justice for the individual, we need to imagine justice in a state.
Right.
I want to take that the opposite way when we're thinking about economics. If we're really going to understand economics on a governmental, on a global scale, we actually need to shrink that down to think about economics for the individual. Because I think ultimately economics is not fundamentally different for governments than it is for people.
Right.
So in which case, if I undertake an obligation to repay a loan, that someone has given me their money and I've said I will return that money to you by this time with this amount of interest, I have a moral obligation as a human being to return that and to fulfill what I've said I would do.
So you're saying just because the government could finance this debt doesn't mean that it should finance
it. Exactly. That it does actually. I think that moral burden is actually part of the fundamental reality of rule of law, and that the government has said we will pay these obligations at this time, but we have this fascinating possibility that's made possible through modern economics and modern technology and modern globalization that really governments could continue borrowing indefinitely. But eventually, just like an individual will eventually hit a point of personal bankruptcy, eventually the willingness of other countries to borrow or to buy another nation's debt runs out. We saw that back a few years back with the nation of Greece when they literally were out of money. They were out of value in their country. And they literally, it's almost comical to put it this way, but Greece was begging from members of the European Union, please give us enough money so that we can keep our country running.
Right.
So it's the same reality that would happen on a personal level.
And paying off this debt could possibly act as a cushion for if the economy did recede, which it has before, and it likely will again, would being debt-free play a role in helping us get back on our feet?
And sure, I think that's a great question. And it brings us to our closing question for today. Really, should a government prioritize long-term or short-term solutions? I think we can see our two sides here.
Right.
I think part of when we're asking this about the United States federal government, we've also got to consider the nature of a democracy. So Ethan, let's close with this question. Do you think a democracy can in fact value long-term solutions?
What a great question. That one really does go deep, but I think a democracy can value long-term decisions. And to kind of put this in a little bit of an example with the resolution, I think that a really good way to argue for the negative team would say that putting certain short-term policies in place that are around financing the debt would actually help make long-term ends more effective than paying off the debt and kind of reversing ourselves in this way. But as a democracy, I feel like we are capable of focusing on long-term decisions, and if we can play it right, then I think this debt could possibly, maybe not go away right away, but definitely get cut down and help us boost our economy in that way and give us more power as far as international maneuverability and national security. But on the flip side, I think the negative could make a strong case for putting smaller policies in place that help to finance the debt and help to keep it manageable while at the same time growing our economy. And who knows, maybe some neg team will find a way to argue that paying off this debt slowly but incrementally could actually help keep the economy strong. And could it pay it off all by itself in the future if the economy were really going this strong? Is that possible?
Well, that really is. I mean, that's the question. That's a question of the debate. And part of in looking at the U.S. federal government as our acting agent in the resolution is that we've also got to consider the fact that the federal government changes its composition every 2, 4, 6, or 8 years.
Right.
So as different parties come to power, for a plan to be effective, we need to also consider the fact that maybe the Democratic Party prioritizes the debt, but then the Republican Party comes in and says, guys, we can all get super rich if we ignore the debt.
Right.
But then 2 years later, a new party arises and it changes the plan yet again. So I think it's at least tricky, and we've got to deal with the fact fact that a democratic government reflects the values of its country. Right. So if our country embraces a value of being debt-free, we might see our government begin to also act as if being debt-free was important. So all of that is stewed in. This promises to be a great debate. And so I'm looking forward to watching you and your partner, Noah, debate on February 16th.
Exciting.
And I think on that note, any last words of advice to our potential debaters who are listening to this?
Debaters, my first word of advice to you would be to go and do as much research as possible. Even if you're not looking particularly for some evidence to fill in a certain argument, read up. Just go for maybe an hour, 2 hours, and read all the articles you can on the United States federal government's debt. Because really, the number one thing I value in a debate is understanding what you're talking about. Because you can make the best constructive speech in the entire world, but when you stand up for rebuttal, if you don't truly understand what you had just said, your opponent can take you down, and they will take you down. So really, really understand the topic so you can get up there in cross-ex and in rebuttal speech and give a good, strong rebuttal. And also, as I've learned from Josh, my debate coach, there's no such thing as the perfect case in debate, which I have made that mistake of thinking that maybe just one more article and just one more here and one more there will make the absolute perfect debate case that cannot be defeated, only to find that those cases can be defeated. So don't kill yourselves writing this case. There are great arguments on each side, and I think that this is going to be a really fun debate that we can all have a lot of fun with and enjoy.
Well, thank you, Ethan, for joining me today on What's the Res, and thank you also to Noah Berman, our audio engineer, for making the magic work today. If you like what you've heard, please leave us a review. You can find What's the Res on SoundCloud, Podbean, iTunes, and you can also check out our show notes on our Medium page. And if you want to email us, please feel free to send us an email at whatstheres@gmail.com. That's WATSRES. No, that's not it. Ethan, jump in. Help my bad spelling.
You can email us at whatstheres@gmail.com. That's WATSTHERES@gmail.com with any of your questions regarding case writing, debate theory, anything you have, we can answer.
Or at least we'll try to.
Join
us next time on What's the Res?